From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds. The United States can reduce its use of oil and coal to zero by the year 2050 without nuclear power, new federal taxes or subsidies, or new inventions. And at the same time, the U.S. can grow the economy by 158%. That's the thesis in Amory Levin's new book. It's called Reinventing Fire. Amory Levins is a physicist, an environmental scientist, and a writer who's been working on energy policy for 40 years. He was named by Time magazine one of the world's 100 most influential people back in 2009. He's been awarded a MacArthur Genius Grant and many other prestigious prizes. He's taught at 10 universities and gotten 11 honorary doctorates. Amory Levins is the chief scientist and co-founder of the Rocky Mountain Institute. It's an independent, entrepreneurial, nonprofit think tank. Great to have you with us.
Nice to be here.
Well, I got to ask you about the issue of the day. In reinventing fire, you say we can get rid of all coal and oil use by 2050. But what about abroad? As you're probably aware, there's a lot of discussion here in the Seattle area right now about a coal port that would ship coal from the Midwest over through Washington State, through the Northwest, and then onward to Asia and China. Do you think by 2050 there is still going to be that kind of demand for coal in the world?
No, I think it's actually going to fade out a good deal earlier, and we can already see this. In the U.S., coal has lost a third of its market in 6 years because it's cheaper to do efficiency, renewables, and gas than to run existing coal plants. But the same business logic applies elsewhere, too. In China, which, of course, is about 70% run on coal, it's kind of 1930s Pittsburgh, except their coal plants are more efficient than ours are today. A very interesting thing's happened. The official statistics show that the growth in coal-fired power generation in the first quarter of this year was more than undone in the second and third quarters while the economy kept growing. That's never happened before. So the coal generation in September was 8% below a year earlier. And this suggests that their very ambitious and aggressive efficiency and renewable efforts are also starting to bite. The other big market is supposedly in India, which has just canceled 42 billion watts of coal plants since March after their business case collapsed because basically other coal exporters have doubled or tripled their prices, trying to price more like oil, and they price themselves out of the market.
Is this just a bump, or is this, do you think, the beginning of a trend when it comes to China and other Asian nations that might want this coal coming through the Northwest?
I think it's the beginning of a very important and hopeful trend. efficiency beats any kind of generation, even in existing plants, and renewables are starting to get very competitive. Wind power often beats the wholesale price in this country. Solar just cleared the California auction in April at below 9 cents a kilowatt hour and falling, even though our systems cost twice as much as the same equipment does in Germany because they install it much more efficiently because they've gone to scale. Well, that shows where we can go. By the way, solar and wind typically are subsidized less than fossil fuel and nuclear competitors.
We also just heard a story about tidal and wave power and some experiments going on with that in the Northwest. And I don't recall seeing at all in Reinventing Fire you talking about that aspect of replacing oil and coal. Do you think that's going to be a factor?
Oh, yeah. There's a little there on marine energy, and it's less mature than things like onshore wind and solar power, but coming on fast. In fact, years ago in work for BC Hydro, we found there's about 2 billion watts of just tidal current potential around Vancouver Island, some of which is so powerful it tears the turbines apart. That's a nice problem to have because you can engineer the turbines not to be torn apart and get a lot more energy.
If you just joined us, I'm talking to Amory Levins. He's studied energy and the environment for 40 years. And in a way, the culmination of the work of the Rocky Mountain Institute, where he's the chief scientist, is Reinventing Fire, subtitled A Bold Business Solutions for the New Energy Era. It talks about how the U.S. can replace all coal and oil we use today by the year 2050 Maybe that raises some questions in your mind. Give us a call, 206-543-5869. That's 206-543-KUOW, 206-800-289-5869 if you're outside our area. Or if you prefer, you can write to us, conversation@kuow.org. Well, one of the first things I noticed about Reinventing Fire is that there are two forewords, one by the president of Shell Oil and the other by the chairman and CEO of Exelon Corporation. Why are the heads of two oil companies kind of endorsing ideas that seem to spell the end of their businesses?
Well, this is not Exxon. This is Exelon, which is the nation's largest nuclear and third largest coal-fired utility. And they graciously wrote these forewords basically saying this is important and you should read it. Not because they agreed with everything in it, but because they thought it was a helpful contribution to honest discussion, and it spoke to their industry's strategic needs and opportunities. That is, how can they use their assets and skills and capabilities to thrive in the new world that's rapidly emerging? And you know, I've worked in the oil business 39 years now, and I'm actually a member of the National Petroleum Council. Our institute has an ELAB, Electricity Innovation Lab, bringing together many leaders from that industry to figure out the next electricity industry. And it's a very exciting time in both, figuring out what to do next to make more money at less risk and provide better service at lower cost.
To what degree are those businesses that, I mean, the Petroleum Institute, it's got the oil right in its name, to what degree are they transferring their business or moving their business over to areas that might have more of a future than oil and coal?
The smarter oil companies are not only moving a lot into gas, but also often into efficiency and renewables. They're diversifying both their activities and their portfolio of options, so they have more smart things to do that they can jump to. And I think that's wise because the oil business is kind of like airlines. It's a great industry and a bad business, and its long-term fundamentals are very unpromising.
Mm-hmm. We've noticed the price of gasoline has been dropping recently in our area, but that probably is not the long-term trend. Just last week, I spoke to Canadian economist and resource analyst Jeff Rubin, and he argues that the changes in our energy future will be driven by high oil prices.
The triple-digit oil prices is our friend, not our enemy. That triple-digit oil prices is going to lead to conservation, whether we want to or not. That triple-digit oil prices is going to change our carbon profile, whether we're willing to make those choices or not.
Will high oil prices be kind of the driver in this move away from oil?
Well, our analysis doesn't count any of the $1.5 trillion a year of hidden economic, military, and economic costs of our oil dependence, nor environmental and global development and stability and national independence and reputation kinds of costs. Certainly not climate change. We didn't count any of that stuff. We just looked at the forecast market price. And yes, the forecasts longer term go to well over $100 a barrel on a sustained basis. However, it turns out that the cost of getting mobility completely off oil averages $25 a barrel. So you don't need high oil prices for that to pencil out. In fact, it's really clear now that oil has become uncompetitive even at low prices before it becomes unavailable even at high prices, just like happened to whale oil in the 1850s. And the whalers were astounded to run out of customers before they ran out of whales. And therefore, this transition is inexorable, driven by existing technology and requiring no act of Congress.
It's so interesting to see you kind of set the global climate change issues to the side in your analysis, as they are usually central to people talking about changing our energy future. It's not that you don't talk about them in the book, but you think even putting them aside, there's still a big economic argument for moving in this direction?
Sure. Climate is a huge national security issue, as the Pentagon will tell you. They see it as a threat multiplier, a source of instability. It makes their job a great deal harder and riskier. But we just made the business case that it's $5 trillion cheaper to get off oil, coal, and ultimately gas than to keep digging up and burning the stuff. You know, we have better ways to run the global economy than burning every year 4 cubic miles of the rotted remains of primeval swamp goo. And Therefore, the result we get is very trans-ideological. That is, whether you most care about profits and jobs and competitive advantage, or about national security, or about environmental stewardship, climate protection, public health, creation care, reinventing fire makes sense and makes money. And if you like any of the outcomes of, if you wish, a 2.6-fold bigger economy, $5 trillion cheaper, 82 to 86% less carbon emission, greater national security. If you like any one or more of those, then you can get behind this transition without needing to like every outcome or believe in every outcome and without needing to agree which outcome is most important. So let's focus on outcomes, not motives.
Amory Lovins, the book has your tone of confidence and assurance that this is the direction to go in. And yet, if it is so clear on so many levels, why is there still so much resistance to it?
Well, as former oilman Murray Strong said, not all the fossils are in the fuel. On the other hand, as Edgar Woolard reminded us when he ran DuPont, companies hampered by old thinking won't be a problem because in the long run they simply won't be around. So what we do at Rocky Mountain Institute, it's an entrepreneurial nonprofit, is help mainly companies to scale this transition and be so conspicuously successful that applies competitive pressure to make the others follow suit or lose share. We use competition to do our outreach.
Give us an example of a company that you helped do that, that maybe gave them a huge advantage or maybe even put their competitors out of business.
Well, there are some very interesting ones that we cannot yet talk about. For example, in the auto sector, watch this space. Although I will say both BMW and Volkswagen, whom we, I think, helped get on this track quite a while ago, are introducing the first mass-produced carbon fiber electric cars in Germany next year. That's been, 20 years in the making. But some of the more interesting examples would be, say, in chip fabs, big business around here. We helped Texas Instruments cut out $230 million of capital cost, or 30%, while saving a lot of energy and water. And that's why the plant was built in Texas, not China, saving about 1,000 high-tech American jobs. And that sort of new benchmark is now spreading through the industry. Our latest data center design with EDS, now part of Hewlett-Packard, the client was so conservative they'd only let us save a third of the energy at the same capital cost. But EDS told us had they been able to follow all of our advice, they would have saved about 95% of the energy and half the capital cost. Or Walmart, through great work with its suppliers, has in 6 years through last year cut their fuel to haul a case of merchandise in their trucks by 44%, with a lot more to go.
Amory Lovins is my guest. We're talking about his new book called Reinventing Fire. The fire, of course, being that generated by oil and coal that made modern society. He thinks by the year 2050, we can remake modern society without either of them here in the United States. We're at 206-543-5869, 800-289-5869, or write to us, conversation@kuow.org. Let's go to Nicholas, who's listening to us this afternoon. And Nicholas, you have a question about peak oil?
I'm wondering if the guest has taken into account the extremely low energy return on energy invested with some of these, well, in fact, all of these alternative energy sources, and whether or not he thinks we're actually going to have the necessary fossil fuel input infrastructure in order to maintain all these technologies in the future. We have to mine all the resources that go into constructing them, and we need a fossil fuel input infrastructure in order to maintain it. What do you think about this?
Good questions.
Well, having helped create the generally accepted accounting principles for net energy analysis back in the 70s, I agree with the principle of what you're saying. That's why we, should do the transition while we still have relatively abundant and cheap fossil fuel. But I don't agree with your analysis because, in fact, the energy payback to build and even take down afterwards a modern wind machine is months. And even for photovoltaics, the energy payback ranges from months to a couple of years, and most of the embodied energy is actually in the glass and aluminum frames, which you can then easily reuse or recycle.
And you think there are enough fossil fuels to build this new renewable energy technology?
Yes, but in fact, a lot of the factories are run by the technologies themselves. SolarX did this with very early photovoltaics, probably 2 decades ago. I was just at a Bloom Energy plant that's making fuel cells, and it's entirely powered by its own fuel cells, just a little clump of them. This is not difficult to do. It is the very exotic frontier kinds of hydrocarbons that have a rapidly diminishing energy return, and that means that the oil shale and tar sands and so on are very energy intensive to produce. However, they're also uneconomic to produce compared with the full slate of alternatives. So if you look at the whole competitive landscape, you actually get the same result looking at the economics as you would looking at the net energy.
And one of the things that you also look at are these huge costs that are going into maintaining the system. I had to read this sentence over twice. You wrote, "I think we spend more to defend the oil supply coming from the Middle East than we pay for the oil itself?"
By a factor 10. Yes, the $500 billion a year we pay for the readiness of military forces whose primary mission is intervention in the Persian Gulf actually rivals our total defense expenditure at the height of the Cold War. So actually, if you look at the bigger picture, when we pay $2 billion a day for oil, that doesn't count another $4 billion a day, or $1.5 trillion a year, that we pay for the economic and military costs of our oil dependence. And that's in three roughly equal parts: $500 billion a year each for those military costs, for the market value of oil price volatility, those jitters that impose risk and cost on every oil user, and just the macroeconomic costs of sucking all that money out of the economy, mainly through OPEC's monopoly pricing, which U.S. oil dependence makes possible. So when you add it all up, not even counting environment and climate and global stability and development, a bunch of other important stuff, oil is costing us upwards of a sixth of GDP, and we cannot go on doing that. But it's a lot cheaper not to.
Imagine, if you will, the year 2050, and the United States uses no oil or coal, uses no nuclear power, without any federal taxes or subsidies, and at the same time, the economy has grown stratospherically. Amory Lovin's new book, Reinventing Fire, imagines just such a future. Amory Lovin's the co-founder and chief scientist at the Rocky Mountain Institute. Foreign Policy magazine calls him one of the 100 top global thinkers. And one of the things that the Rocky Mountain Institute is known for is its work on transportation and automobiles that you've written about a lot in the past. And as I read this section of the book, the transformation of vehicles often focuses on whether it's going to be hybrid or electric. And you take what some might think of as the more mundane areas, but actually the way the cars are built, the structure of the cars, the composition of the cars really paves the way for all these changes in how they're moved.
Now, the reason for that is that 2/3 of the energy it takes to move a typical automobile is caused by its weight. So the most important thing you can do to save energy in a car is to take out obesity. Because we've had an epidemic of it. Our 2-ton steel cars have gained weight for the quarter century twice as fast as we have. But we can now take out 1/2 or 2/3 of that weight while improving safety by using modern ultra-light, ultra-strong materials like the carbon fiber composites that the Dreamliner is half made of. And it turns out this can so simplify the manufacturing and so shrink the propulsion system that the ultralighting is approximately free rather than very costly as had been assumed, because you save 80% of the capital cost. You save 98 or 99% of the tooling cost. The body shop can go away. Most or all of the paint shop can go away. Those are the two hardest, costliest steps in making the car. Well, when you get a car that moves with 2 or 3 times less energy and costs about the same to build, guess what? Because the propulsion system is about 2 or 3 times smaller, that means you save up to 2/3 of the costly fuel cells or batteries. So now you can afford to electrify it and get rid of the rest of the oil at a total cost of about $18 per barrel saved. And it's just like drilling under Detroit and finding there 1.5 Saudi Arabias or half an OPEC for $18 a barrel, and that those nega barrels, save barrels, are all American, carbon-free, secure, and inexhaustible.
And the painting aspect of the cars I thought was really interesting because you can put the color into the composite material as you make it rather than having to paint metal after the fact.
And the mold, there's a half dozen or so ways to do that that are rapidly maturing. And we're working with automakers and suppliers to help bust the barriers to this big change. And the biggest, toughest parts of the change are actually not so much technical or economic as they're cultural. Changing the design process and the manufacturing mentality and how we count cost. Like, we need to count cost by the car, not by the part or by the pound. We need to count what we've already invested in as a sunk cost, not an unamortized asset. So if it's cheaper not to run it than to run it, we should not run it and do the new thing instead before our competitors do. So, and this turns out, by the way, to be a terrific competitive strategy, which is, I think, why BMW and Volkswagen have gotten into it so aggressively. The BMW has confirmed that their i3's carbon fiber is paid for by needing fewer batteries. And they say, we do not intend to be a typewriter maker, because they can look across Munich to where Olympia used to make excellent typewriters. Mm-hmm. Volkswagen's new XL1, also coming out in 2013, has 230 miles a gallon. Audi just showed a concept, not production yet, SUV carbon fiber plug-in hybrid rated at over 250 miles a gallon. This is getting pretty exciting because, you know, I cooked up this sort of combination back in 1991, and now we're starting to see them coming into the showrooms.
I mentioned this idea of lighter cars, and the first person I mentioned it to said, well, how could they be safe?
Well, because the materials can absorb 6 to 12 times as much crash energy per pound of steel and do so more smoothly, and that more than makes up for the lightness compared to what Wang's India. So just go online and look up crashes in Formula One or Champ cars. These are ultralight carbon fiber cars. They run into a wall at 180 plus miles an hour with, say, nine times the crash energy that you would have hitting a bridge abutment at 60. And the car flies to bits, and the driver generally limps away with bruises and maybe a broken foot.
And how about the cost of these carbon composite materials? It's pretty high right now, isn't it?
Oh, the materials are costlier, but the car costs about the same. That's why you have to look at the whole system. Because of the simpler manufacturing and because the propulsion system gets several times smaller, I actually brought along a piece of carbon fiber composite structure that was made in 1 minute 7 years ago. It looks kind of like a bowl.
Like a black salad bowl, yeah, large black salad bowl.
And if I hit it, I'll hold it a little away from the microphone so it doesn't overwhelm your sound system. It rings like a bell, which tells you how immensely stiff and strong it is. Tom Friedman actually whacked it as hard as he could with a sledgehammer and couldn't even scuff it. It's tougher than titanium.
Yeah, but it's a dishwasher safe.
Oh, yes, and actually food grade.
One of the areas, you don't talk a lot about government's role in this, but one area you do is when it comes to cars. You say that the government can steer the car business in the right direction by mandating fee baits. What is a fee bait?
Actually, this would probably be best done first at a state level, which is likely where it will happen first. A fee bait means rebates for efficient new autos of whatever type and size you want, paid for by corresponding fees on inefficient ones of the same type and size. So it's revenue neutral, it's size neutral, but it broadens the price spread by maybe thousands of dollars between the most and least efficient autos of each kind. That means you can invest as a private buyer with the same long view, the same 15-year view of fuel savings that society finds important. And just in the first 2 years, the biggest of five such efforts in Europe tripled the speed of improving auto efficiency.
How do you keep the calibration right? I mean, if people get rid of the gas guzzlers quicker than you might have anticipated, you might be paying out more to the low mileage cars.
Well, sure. That's why you have to true it up every year to keep it revenue neutral. So it's neither a revenue flow to nor from the Treasury. But that's straightforward to do, and we've done a workshop with industry figuring out how to design it. And by the way, both dealers and automakers will make a lot more money this way.
a lot of people, when they think about moving to a future without oil or coal, talk about a carbon tax as a way of doing that. I don't see you endorsing that at all in this book. Why is that?
Well, it would be appropriate and correct and helpful to price carbon instead of pretending that putting it in the air is free. But we still got a $5 trillion net present value saving without doing that, without counting any of the external or hidden costs of burning all this fossil fuel. Therefore, we don't need to argue about whether carbon tax or cap and trade equivalently should happen or will happen. We don't hang our argument on it. It would just make things happen a little better and faster if we did it. Basically, carbon is already priced to the extent that every CO2 molecule you put up in the air has a price tag on it. It's called your fuel bill. And it's cheaper to save the fuel than to buy it and burn it.
I'm talking to Amory Lovins. He's the co-founder and chief scientist at the Rocky Mountain Institute, and the book is called Reinventing Fire. If you'd like to ask him a question about what we're talking about, some provocative ideas, we're at 206-543-5869. That's 206-543-KUOW, 800-289-5869. Or write to us, conversation@kuow.org. where we got this email, which comes to us from a listener who writes, "The president of Shell Oil wrote the foreword to your book, but Shell is eager to get involved with a controversial offshore drilling project in the Arctic Ocean. If oil is going away, as you say, why is Shell Oil so eager to make that investment?"
They think they can make money on it. They think they can do it safely. Time will tell whether either of those is true. They are taking a big business risk. It's not one I would advise. But I don't make their policy, even though I've given them some advice for a long time. You notice that what they are not doing, and neither is any oil major, is pressing to drill in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge on shore. The reason for that is that there's absolutely no business case. I've talked to the people at each of the oil majors who have secret drilling data, and they say the geology is really ugly. The more we look at it, the worse it looks, the less interested we get. And if technology keeps improving, it actually will disadvantage that oil compared to everything else in our list of prospects around the world. It's at the bottom of the list. It's going to stay there. We don't want to go there.
Are we apt to see fewer cars on the road, though? As I was reading this, you were talking about the fact that we might see roads open up, but you also would include a plan to discourage driving.
Not to discourage driving so much as to get the same access without unnecessary driving that simply takes time away from our families and imposes hassle and congestion. So if you charge for road infrastructure, as we have to, it's not free, by the mile, not the gallon, which has been pioneered in some tests in the Northwest, and you use smart information technology to enhance public transit and encourage car sharing and ride sharing and smooth flow of traffic. And if you help real estate developers use smart growth and new urbanist models so folks are already where they want to be and don't need to go somewhere else, you can get the same access with about 46 to 84% less driving than was otherwise forecast in 2050, and we would have stronger communities, stronger families, better lives, and you wouldn't give up anything except sitting in traffic jams.
Well, traffic engineers tell me it's a losing cause. You take cars off the road, you make it easier to drive, then more people drive. You just can't.
You have to take account of that effect, but it's actually relatively small, and what's most important is that more people are getting more access with less physical mobility, less need to run around, especially in a car. And basically what we're asking for, although we don't assume it, is that all ways to get around or not need to should compete fairly at honest prices. So there was actually, I think, a move around Seattle at one point to pay people for not driving across a particular bridge which was overloaded, and I think that worked out pretty well.
There are different tactics you can take, but I want to get back to the roads because the governor of Washington, outgoing governor, has a budget proposal on transportation coming out, I believe, next week, and it's she may be asking for a higher gas tax, and it's sort of a losing proposition. There are people already who are spending less on gasoline. They're going to electric cars, hybrid cars. Less gas is purchased, less money to repair and keep the roads up, and it's already created a huge backlog in Washington State and many other states.
Sure. Well, the Highway Trust Fund nationwide is broke and going broker. It's not inflation indexed. So the money they get's been going down for a long time. And as you say, the more efficient cars get and the more they use alternative fuels, the less money they get out of the gasoline tax. So that's why it's important to charge by the mile, not by the gallon. And of course, we have a more basic choice of how much to socialize these costs. When David Walters was governor of Oklahoma, he was criticized for putting in a toll road. And so, well, there's only two kinds of roads. There's user-supported roads and tax-supported roads. Which kind would you rather have? Anyone the argument?
Well, certainly user-paid-for roads makes a lot of sense. But when you're looking at a state like ours that's facing like $1 billion shortfall in the budget next year, how do you get over the capital costs of installing GPS things in every automobile so that you can charge for the number of miles traveled? How do you get over that hump?
I think it pays back pretty fast. GPS is so cheap, it's in every smartphone. And a lot of cars already have the software. You don't need to keep track of where the car is. You just need to know how much it drives. And you could actually read that off the odometer when you do a smog check or otherwise. And it turns out to greatly reduce excess driving and save money for everybody. It's a good deal to charge by the mile. And just realize there are no free roads, there are no free bridges. You got to pay for them. But we got about a third of people in this country who are too old or young or poor or infirm to drive, and they are paying for driver's costs. When that coalition gets together and realizes that it is bearing the burden of other people's driving, I think we will see an unprecedented new kind of tax revolt against the socialization of driving costs. And as a Canadian friend of mine said, realize that drivers should get what they pay for, but should pay for what they get.
Amory Lovins is my guest. We're talking about his new book called Reinventing Fire. He takes a look at the major sectors that use energy in our country. We're talking a lot about transportation. He also looks at buildings and industry and electric generation, along with the help of a lot of co-authors and reviewers. It's a book full of facts and information on the innovations that are already underway that he thinks could lead us to the year 2050 when we are not using any coal or oil at all in this country. Let's go to Steve. He's up on Capitol Hill, and he's got a question for Amory Lovins. Steve, go right ahead.
Hi. Yes, I recently picked up a book called Superfuels. I can't remember the name of the author, but it's touting the use of a little-known alternative to uranium called thorium as a greener alternative that's more abundant, less toxic. What are your thoughts on that?
This is a very old idea from the 40s and 50s. There are good reasons it has not been commercialized. It has a band of hardy enthusiasts, many of whom don't really know what they're talking about, and they often claim that it doesn't have nuclear waste and it isn't proliferative. That is, neither of those is true. It differs only in detail from present uranium fuel cycles, which are hopelessly uneconomic to build. They're out of the money by a factor probably at least five, which is why all of the nuclear plants under construction worldwide were bought by central planners, not through a market process, and why with 100+% construction subsidies for new reactors in this country, we're seeing only a handful built, and those all compulsorily financed by customers and taxpayers. So if the nuclear one-third of a new nuclear plant were free, the other two-thirds would still be grossly uncompetitive with efficiency, cogeneration, and renewables. There's no business case. End of story. Thorium doesn't change that, and thorium reactors are not free. It's also about 50 years too late. to start a whole new fuel cycle. And if you think you can get around the economic challenge by mass producing lots of little reactors, just remember reactors don't scale down well as a matter of physics. That's why we made them big. And if you tried mass producing them, you would then run up against the thing they cannot handle now. They're competing with small modular renewables, which do scale down well and are decades ahead in capturing their economies of mass production, and you can't ever catch up.
Hey, thanks a lot for your phone call, Steve. Thanks for all of your phone calls. If you'd like to leave a comment, you can do it at our Facebook page, KUOW's The Conversation. You've been listening to Amory Lovins. His book that he wrote with the Rocky Mountain Institute is called Reinventing Fire, Bold Business Solutions for the New Energy Era. We just kind of scratched the surface on some of the many aspects he goes into of how this works. Thank you so much for coming by. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Our program is produced by David Hyde with Arwin Nix. Cameron Drews helps us on the production end, and Andrew Hurst is in control. From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds.